what a year 2008 was. We had a global economic crisis that began, it seems, with people or bankers in the United States lending money for homes to people in the US who couldn't afford them. But it just exploded around the world, and it has directly affected you. We had the highest prices we'd ever paid for petrol at the pump. We thought that that would be, it would be like that forever. But now we're going back to under a dollar a litre. We began the year with Australia as the unchallenged number one cricket team and rugby league team in the world. We end the year possibly in number two position in both cricket and rugby league. We had a Melbourne Cup where the horse that ran second ran faster than the horse that ran first and then was nearly disqualified. What an extraordinary year it has been, even allowing for the fact that we saw a black man elected president of the United States. We had the apology to the stolen generation, something that many people thought would never happen. The Olympics went to China, and, well, controversy in the arts world over photographs that were seized from a gallery in Paddington in Sydney of naked children. Those photos are now freely available to be purchased if you buy David Marr's book of the Henson controversy. And Baz Luhrmann's long-awaited Australia was released to generally positive reviews, but a disappointing box office. What a remarkable year. And Stephen Mayne, founder of Crikey.com, and, well, one of the people who appeared on Talking Heads with Peter Thompson this year, is back to talk about this amazing year. Stephen, thank you so much for your time.
It's a pleasure, Rod.
Shall we begin chronologically or in level of importance, perhaps? Maybe we start with the economic crisis. I mean, you're someone who knows a lot about the way the economics world works. How did it all begin? Was it the subprime crisis?
Well, I think if you go back a bit further, we had very loose monetary policy in the US. Greenspan kept interest rates very low just after the start of the Iraq War in 2003. With loose monetary policy, and then we had a five-year credit binge where there was just too much cash sloshing all over the world, and people were no longer pricing in risk. They were lending money willy-nilly to anyone. So junk bonds in the US, you only had to pay 2% more than the government rate at the peak of this boom. And I guess the worst excesses of this particular boom were in subprime housing, where a couple of million Americans were given home loans who clearly couldn't afford to pay it back. They had, you know, often no income, no job, and they'd borrow more than 100%. So when the US housing market started to come off in 2005, 2006, the first cracks emerged, and then it seriously crashed in the last sort of 12 to 18 months. And this has triggered more than $1 trillion of write-offs from the investors all over the world who bought these packaged-up subprime loans, which were often AAA-rated, not realizing that they really were a house of cards if the housing market in the US crashed.
As it did. And then I don't know whether these people who run these banks or the lenders or the lending institutions realised it would then affect them, and we saw Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers and many others under terrible problems and either went under or were rescued by the US government. And then we get all the way down to General Motors, one of the biggest and most famous corporations in the world, having to go cap in hand to the US government, and we saw a Republican administration that did not believe, or generally does not believe, in interfering with the market, basically socializing a lot of industries in the United States. It was stunning.
Yes, you couldn't have written the script any better. I mean, anyone who, if you said that to anyone 12 months ago, you know, you'd be locked up. It was just one remarkable, unprecedented event after the other. I mean, some of us were just staggered when it was a lot of foreign government sovereign funds that were initially putting in all the money to recapitalize all these Wall Street banks. You know, the Chinese, the South Koreans, the Qataris, the Singaporeans, several other Middle Eastern oil states put in literally more than $50 billion in pumping money into banks all over the world, and the US government sat back and was doing nothing. And then when the crisis continued and Bear Stearns collapsing on March 17 was a very important moment. And then the losses kept on coming to the point where we got to September And we had the collapse of Lehman Brothers, and that then triggered what I think was a whole new wave in the global financial crisis, and that will go down as the folly of regulation for the rest of our lifetime. There was certain institutions that were too big to fail, and Lehman Brothers was one of them, and the chaos that was unleashed by its bankruptcy literally just seized up the global financial system and caused banks to be nationalised all over the world, governments to print money, interest rates to be cut down to near zero in the US and Japan and these places, and then the follow-on effect to the real economy when Wall Street hit Main Street, and we saw US car sales falling by 40 and 50%, and then, of course, various industries all being hit, putting their hands out to be nationalised. So an amazing situation starts with housing in the US. Then with Lehman Brothers collapsing, we really experienced for the first time how globally interwoven and complicated the whole financial system was that had been created. And if one key player goes down, it just causes chaos. And we're still picking up the pieces from that.
What about here in Australia? We generally seem to think that we've avoided this. I think it's probably too early to say that, but Australia has not been as badly affected, obviously, as the United States.
Well, certainly, because we have the world's most expensive banking system, our banks are incredibly strong. So we're one of the few countries that hasn't had to directly nationalise our banks, albeit the Rudd government did have to come in and guarantee borrowings. And if, on other measures, like the fact that our unemployment rate is still only 4.4%, you'd say that we look like we've actually come through it pretty well. But equally, never before has the Australian dollar plunged from, you know, a high of 98 cents down to 60 cents in a matter of weeks. And clearly we were treated as one of the high-risk economies by the rest of the world. And when we have $1 trillion of foreign debt and a current account deficit of $60 billion a year, we as a nation are highly dependent on foreign capital, equity and debt, and had been benefiting from the resources bubble. And clearly, we saw after July, we saw the resources bubble burst, with oil falling from $147 a barrel in July to just $37 this week. Things like nickel and copper falling by 71 and 67% respectively. It was an unprecedented crash in our biggest earner, that is the mining industry. And that is why the Australian stock market has halved. And I think you're going to see a lot more job losses and problems in Australia in 2009, because the ripple effect of the end of the resources boom, coupled with our high dependency on foreign capital at a time when foreign banks are fleeing, does put together a pretty scary scenario.
Some people did okay. If you were paying off a house, you wanted your interest rates to fall, and that's happened. If you're driving a car, you want petrol prices to fall, and that has happened. If you are safe in a job, then you might look back at the year and think, you know what, we escaped unscathed. Is that unfair to say that?
No, I think that's actually quite a reasonable way to look at it. But most people now have superannuation, which is linked to the market, so they have accumulation schemes. So if you're a longer-serving public servant and you're on a fixed pension for your super, you'd missed out on the boom in the previous 5 years when the stock market almost tripled, but at least you still will have your fixed CPI-linked pension going forward. But admittedly, even these people who've got fixed pensions, they'll be living in houses which are coming off in value and will probably come off further. And they'll know people, other members of their family who've been hit. So it's very hard to look around and say, you know, there are winners and losers. Relatively speaking, it has hit business, and it has hit those who run their businesses or have big investments in stock markets, self-funded retirees, these types. It's hit them harder than your ordinary working families who might not have a big share portfolio and have a mortgage and have certainly saved a lot. I mean, when you've got $1 trillion of household debt, as Australia has, to cut interest rates from 7.25% to 4.25% in just a few months, that represents a saving of $30 billion a year in interest, which is a massive fillip to the battling mortgage holders in Australia. So, yeah, certainly they have benefited substantially from this.
I would ask you to predict what might happen next year, but if anything we've learnt this year is that those whose jobs it is to predict should not be listened to, perhaps. That there may have been some people who were predicting this at the start of the year, but most people would not have predicted that the All Ordinaries or the Dow Jones would fall as much as they have. What has happened to those whose job it is to predict the way that the markets will go? Do they have, I suppose, any credibility anymore?
Well, I guess in it's not a bit tough to blame people for not predicting the biggest shock to hit financial markets since the Great Depression. So clearly, I think the main anger should go towards the policy makers and the regulators who created the circumstances and the bankers who created the shadow banking system, or the investment bankers and the ratings agencies who did the dodgy loans. So I think just the economists and the forecasters who were looking at the world as we'd known it for the past few years. I mean, you're right, even the biggest bears were predicting maybe that the stock market would fall by 30%. So certainly everyone got it wrong. But if you're making a prediction going forward, there's very divergent views. A lot of people say, and I agree with this view, that it's long-term great value at the moment, that if you buy stocks or assets at the moment, they will recover because the world is still in psychological shock from this whole financial collapse. But equally, Australian banks still haven't really been hit like banks all over the world. And our financial services sector peaked at 44% of our stock market. So we are a very financially services-based economy.
Yeah.
We're a very property-based economy, and property's been hit all over the world, plus the resources boom. So I personally think that we might actually see the All Ordinaries come off some more, particularly bank stocks, and we're going to see a big increase in bad debts from banks, because there will be a dramatic increase in unemployment, and people just won't have the ability to service that $1 trillion in household debt. So I think that final wave for Australia will probably be more problems for the banks with bad debts, an increase in unemployment, and another smoky I'll throw in for you, Rod,
yes,
problems for state governments.
Yeah.
I think you probably will see the federal government having to come in, and particularly New South Wales,
yeah,
actually help out the state governments in their $20 billion a year borrowing programs, which
yeah,
they've all got, plus being crunched with dwindling revenues from the crashing property market and things like that. So
That's right. Being
hit from all sides at the states.
Yes, they rely so much on the stamp duty. But what has happened with the states, of course, they've sold off anything that makes money, have kept or the only things that don't make money, like trains and schools and hospitals, and they can't make money out of any of those things. Let's now jump to the biggest soap opera of the year, and that was the American election. It began, perhaps, with some people seeing Hillary Clinton as a front runner, but Barack Obama had been running for a year before the first primaries, and he won the first caucuses in Iowa, then Hillary Clinton won the primary in New Hampshire. It was sort of neck and neck all the way to the convention when finally Obama won, and then he, of course, bested John McCain in the general election. This was, for those who love their politics, this was a year to savor, wasn't it?
Well, it was historic in so many respects, and I think what we've seen is Barack Obama ran the most flawless campaign that most people can recall, and equally the most well-moneyed campaign, the best grassroots campaign, featuring some of the best speech-making that we've seen in a long time. I mean, to think about the fact that he spent officially $740 million US, much of which was raised, about $500 million of which was raised from an estimated 3 million internet donors, was just a phenomenal grassroots campaigning appeal, which he did. And he took on the Clintons, who did the traditional sort of big money politics of celebrity endorsements and big donations from the political elite. And it was just an astonishing execution of a brilliant campaign with a combination of money, the star candidate, and just tapping into that vein, that rich vein of change, which was the key message that the American people warmed to. And now the pressure's on for him to deliver this change.
That is the key, because it's all very well to win, but you've got to then do it. And really, he's got a bigger job than any president in history, perhaps with the exception of maybe George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and Franklin Roosevelt.
Well, I think you'd have to say that, and it brings us back to the global economic crisis. He's talking about a $700 billion US dollar stimulus package, which is on top of the $750 billion troubled asset relief program, which is now, there's been talk about that being used to help bail out the car makers. 500,000 increase in unemployment in November alone. Afghanistan getting worse, Iraq getting better, but still two difficult foreign wars, a total government debt over there, including all the government borrowing agencies of Fannie and Freddie of $14 trillion, and a nation borrowing at the rate of $1 trillion a year. Something's got to give there. And clearly, if he's going to deliver his program of a wider health care to all Americans and tax cuts for 95% of American families, which is a very big promise to make, he can't do all of that in the short space of time. And he's now busily managing expectations and already on his victory speech talking about how it'll probably take more than just one term to deliver the change that he wants all Americans to believe in.
And everyone wants to believe in it. Everyone wants to know or think that this man can do something. In a way, he's taken office at the worst time possible. But also, if it had been last year or the year before, if there's so much hope, I think, being pinned on the fact that there is a change in administration when this global crisis is, well, it's kind of gone quiet a bit now, but that there is going to be a change. If it was December last year or the year before, I think there'd be a lot more gloom and doom in the world, wouldn't there?
Well, I agree. At one level, it presents a unique opportunity because all the stars are aligned for some far-reaching change. Whether it's the climate change people are going to look at years and years and years of battling with Detroit and gas guzzlers, and they're now going to see an administration which is basically bailing out the car industry and simultaneously saying we've got to do something with fuel economy and electric cars and these types of things, and we're going to spend hundreds of billions of dollars of taxpayers' money to do it. So I think on things like climate change and environmental issues around the car industry, you will see dramatic change, which we won't have seen for a long time. The other big one is the peace dividend, just that goodwill that goes to Obama from around the world, whether he can use that to extricate the Americans from Iraq, to deal with the increasingly difficult situation in Afghanistan, and maybe get a peace dividend of being able to cut the American defense spend, which is $500 billion a year and out of control. So if he can pull all those together, get the regulations back, get world confidence back in America, having exported this financial poison to the world, if you can turn that around, then he'll go down as one of the true legends. But boy, what a job.
It is indeed. I don't envy him. Stephen Mayne is our guest, and we're talking about the news stories of the year. In Australia, Kevin Rudd, the Prime Minister, has changed the nation, ratified the Kyoto Protocol at the end of last year, and then this year it began with the apologies for the stolen generation. There was the 2020 summit, which has pretty much been forgotten, I've got to say. I don't know whether anything will come of that. And then the economic crisis, which he kind of dealt with by throwing money at it, $10 billion to pensioners, to carers, to low-income Australians. What about Kevin Rudd? What kind of a year has he had? Has it been a good year? Do you think he can look back and think, well, I did my best?
Well, I think you'd have to say that he was batting on the stickiest of all wickets.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a real shocker for him to bat on. And I think he got the symbolism right early on with the issues that you mentioned, including also Australia's first female Governor-General in Quentin Bryce. Mm-hmm. Then a bit of criticism. He was jet-setting too much, and everything was being sent off to reviews. Yes. So he was the jet-setting reviewer. And then he suddenly got all bolshy and with the economic security package and spent $10 billion in one weekend, guaranteed unlimited guarantee of bank deposits, then another $5 billion infrastructure spending spree. Suddenly the $22 billion surplus is pretty much gone. Mm. And, he's a man of action. And I think overall, particularly on the discipline of the government, I mean, John Howard lost several ministers in his first year in office. And his ratings went through the floor. Kevin Rudd, micromanager that he is, hasn't lost any ministers, hasn't really had any scandals, remains reasonably high in the polls. And I think you'd have to say, for a first-time Prime Minister, it's been a pretty solid performance on a sticky wicket.
When it comes to sport, the Beijing Olympics dominated the year, even though perhaps the greatest sporting event of the year was the Wimbledon final, when Rafael Nadal and Roger Federer battled out what some people say is the greatest tennis match ever played. But at the Olympics, it was more than just sport. We had our share of gold medalists, of course. I hope people can remember their names, because quite often you forget them after a couple of months. To me, the Olympics seemed like years ago. Everyone hoped that it would change China, but so far there doesn't appear to be any evidence of that, does there?
Well, people are saying it triggered the economic collapse because straight after the Olympics, the economic activity slowed in China, and I think it's a bit rough to make that link. But certainly, all those military drummers was just a remarkable vision to have from the opening ceremony. And then the statement of China winning the gold medal tally. I mean, they finished up with 51 gold ahead of the US with 36, although the Americans topped the overall tally with 110 to China's 100. But just for to knock off the Americans from that gold, to host the Olympics with, overall very well hosted and well organized event, it was all about the rise of China and decoupling and stronger for longer and who needs the Americans. And that all disappeared within weeks as we suddenly went into this massive slowdown. And I guess that symbolism was a big part of the story. But also, I thought that Usain Bolt's world record in the 100 was one of the great hello world moments. Really was, where and Michael Phelps, of course, with his 8 golds and to get to 14 overall, the world record holder in that regard. So I think it's hard to sort of remember the Olympics too well with the crisis that just took off straight after it, but I think obviously it was one of the big events of the year for sure.
Just hope that we don't find that some of those gold medalists were drug affected, as I'm sure at some stage we might. I won't ask you about the Rugby League World Cup final, Stephen, but what about the cricket? Australia has gone from first to second, it appears. We may explain, in fact, South Africa needs to win the series 3-0 to be officially the number one test team in the world. So if they only win 2-0 or 2-1, a lot of people are going to be very upset because Australia will still be number one.
Well, I think just losing our first series at home since the Windies defeat in 92-93, the 15 years since we lost at home, the symbolism of that will just be be phenomenal. I mean, it's been a shocker of a year for Australian sport. I mean, even the Crusaders beat the Waratahs. Mm. We struggled to beat Wales in the rugby union. We haven't got an Australian in the top 50 in the tennis or the cricket. Yeah. In the tennis men's or women. Yeah. We did finish in the sixth in the medal tally in the Olympics. But overall, I think if we drop this Test match tomorrow as now expected, I think you'd put it down as one of our worst years in quite a while when it comes to sport.
Greg Norman ran third after he led the British Open until the ninth hole of the final round, and he blew it once again. I thought this year would be different, Stephen. Why did I go to bed and get up in the middle of the night hoping or thinking that it would be different? It wasn't.
Well, it'd been 10 years since we'd all experienced that, just one last. But it was it was a great story while it lasted. But he never was a good Sunday golfer, Greg, was he?
He never was. He got that Saturday slam in '86, where he led into the final round of all four majors. A couple of arts stories, of course. The huge movie was Australia, but the big controversy came with the photographer Bill Henson. Police seized a number of the photographer's work from the Rosalind Oxley Gallery in Sydney on the 22nd of May. Came out of the blue because somebody, I think, complained, it may have been Hetty Johnston, about it after reading about it in a newspaper article. No one had actually seen the pictures before the police had seized them. Later found not to be child porn, and now if you go into a shop and buy David Marr's book about the case, the Henson case, two of the photos are in it.
I think if you look back at it, you'd say, wow, what an impact. Bill Henson has a new exhibition every 2 years, so he'd been working on this one for a couple of years. The email invitations were sent around, inviting people to have a private view. It included one of the images of this 13-year-old girl, nude image of a 13-year-old girl. And you're right, Miranda Devine, one column in the Sydney Morning Herald, Hetty Johnson from Braveheart, 8 complaints with the police, and lo and behold, the opening is closed, the images are confiscated, the local area commander of the police force announces that there'll be potential charges for, quote, publishing an indecent article under the Crimes Act. The Prime Minister labels it absolutely revolting and declares the art has no artistic merit. And surprise, surprise, it was Malcolm Turnbull who actually came out and said, I've got a couple of Hensons and I think we should all calm down a bit. And then, not surprisingly, the DPP didn't lay any charges and it was a storm in a teacup. I think you'd say is a reasonable summary, although there are still some very complex and sensitive issues around pedophilia and these issues in the community. And we had in Melbourne in particular, after David Marr's book came out, we had a subsequent controversy where the principal of the St Kilda Park Primary School had allowed Bill Henson to walk around the schoolyard looking for potential subjects for his photographs. And that was another front page, you know, Henson Trawls Schoolyard, which was another sort of beat up that came to nothing, but was a lesson in the heightened sensitivities around child welfare issues in the modern era.
I don't think we need to get into it again here, but it's not over, there's no doubt about it. We don't know what's going to happen to Bill Henson's career, and we don't know whether it is legal to photograph naked children. If you're an artist, it is. If you're not, it's not. And maybe, of course, you're going to get the permission of the parents or the children, but it's an issue that is not going to go away, and it may be revisited in a couple of years when Bill Henson does his next exhibition.
I think that's probably right. And at the same time, you've got the Rudd government grappling with internet censorship issues in the name of not accessing child porn on the web, but in a proposal which is going far further than most democratic nations. So it is a really vexing issue for policymakers, police and artists. And Australia, I think, is surprised on the downside just with its excessive response, I think, particularly around the Henson issue and the internet censorship issue we're seeing from Senator Conroy at the moment.
Yes. As I mentioned, Baz Luhrmann's Australia was the big Australian movie of the year. Not the best. I thought that was The Black Balloon, and most people seem to agree. But it's hard to remember. I don't think there ever was an Australian film that came with as much hype as Australia. The people that have seen it, that have spoken to me, say they liked it. Critics were kind of lukewarm. The public in America have not rushed to embrace it. Oprah loved it, and that was about it. What have we learnt from the lessons of Australia, do you think, Stephen?
Well, I guess it's that the public can't be persuaded. When you get the whole sort of News Corporation machine, plus the whole Australian tourism machine, a whole national advertising tourism program getting behind one movie, you would think, I just sort of thought that, geez, if it's half decent, it'll absolutely fly. Mm. So I must admit, I was very surprised that it didn't take off in a much bigger way. And, I mean, I guess, interestingly, the late Heath Ledger as the Joker, biggest movie of the year, $900 billion US worldwide. So probably an appropriate epitaph for Heath Ledger to go out in the blockbuster of the movie in the year when the national movie from his country didn't really live up to the hype, certainly as far as the box office was concerned.
Maybe if Heath Ledger had starred in Australia rather than Hugh Jackman.
I think maybe you have the answer there.
Not going to see it, unfortunately.
No.
Stephen Mayne is our guest. We're talking about the news, big news stories of the year, and we'd love it if you could join us as well. 1-300-800-222. What story meant the most to you this year? It could be a big one, might be a little one. We'd like it to be in the news, not in your own personal life. 1-300-800-222. We'd love to talk to you this evening. 1-300-800-222. There's plenty more that we can talk about, Stephen. Kind of internationally, apart from the global financial crisis and the Olympics, the one that surprised people was the battle over South Ossetia. It came out of nowhere, even though I'm sure it's been bubbling along for quite a while. What can we learn from that as well? I think a lot of people still don't really know what to make of the South Ossetia situation.
Well, we were all just enjoying the Olympics, weren't we? Yeah. Around about, I think it was August 6 or 7. And all of a sudden, the Georgians foolishly started bombarding the South Ossetian capital, launching these rocket launches after there'd been some shelling by the South Ossetian militia, which was designed to provoke Saakashvili, the Georgian leader, into attacking, and he did. And then, lo and behold, out came the Russian military, and in 3 days they'd smashed the Georgians. And the Europeans and the Americans sort of looked rather limp straight after that because the Georgians were clearly expecting some support. Mm. And it wasn't to come from the Russians, who were suddenly emboldened from the oil price spike. They had $500 billion of reserves, and they had all the gas that Europe needs, and Putin was strutting, and everyone just left him alone. And the French, Sarkozy, got in there on behalf of Europe, the French leader, and managed to get some UN observers and peacekeepers into there eventually. But the great irony was that the whole Russian sort of posturing and excessive response led to a great flight of capital from Russia just as we were heading into the global crisis. And then Russia's turned out to be one of the biggest victims of the global crisis. Yes. They've seen their foreign reserves dwindle by about 200 billion. They had 200,000 jobs disappear in November alone. They've had some protests which have been on the rise. A lot of their billionaires are getting bailed out by the Russian government. And basically the whole focus has gone back to Russian economic management, corruption and transparency and these issues. And I think Putin would look back and say, well, you know, as much as we'd like to, we wanted to smash Saakashvili and the Georgians, hasn't really helped too much in a capital-constrained world where we need the world's capital, despite the fact that we might have a bit of gas and oil around the place.
Yes, there's so much to talk about, and we've got to get to some calls now, but what we haven't even mentioned is Iraq and Afghanistan. And I just saw an interesting story in the New York Times today that said that American networks are kind of moving out of Iraq, and they no longer cover it very much on their TV screens. The three network evening newscasts in the United States this year devoted 423 minutes to Iraq compared with 1,888 last year. So there's maybe because not so many people are being killed there, maybe we hope that democracy is coming to Iraq, but it seems as though that had really fallen off the agenda, hasn't it?
Well, as I read that story as well, it was very interesting to see a nation can have 130,000 troops still in Iraq and no full-time war correspondent from any of the three major television networks. So I guess the emphasis is moving to the whole Afghanistan-Pakistan area. There's the 30,000 troops in Pakistan, but all the reports and the death toll and just the whole resurrection of the Taliban and the lawlessness taking over, you know, large slabs of Afghanistan has got the focus, and that's what Senator Obama or Barack Obama has been talking about, was that we've got to shift the focus to Afghanistan. So the forgotten war will probably become the Iraq war, which is partly a testament to the amazing turnaround. The strategy of David Petraeus of protecting the citizens first and dealing with the Sunni insurgency to become part of the counterinsurgency has led to a dramatic improvement in security. And I think you will see, I think the UN mandate finishes on January 1. So the Iraqis are talking about having all foreign troops out by July of next year. I think the Americans had hoped to stay or were expecting to stay to about 2011. But basically, it's improved. They'll be getting out, and big challenges in Pakistan and Afghanistan to come.
Let's start with Patrick in Swan Hill. G'day, Patrick.
Oh, g'day. G'day, Steve and Mr. Host. I didn't quite catch
Rod Quinn is my name, Patrick.
Yeah, Rob, yeah.
Rod, actually. But anyway, go on quickly, mate. We've got a lot of callers.
Steve, I agreed with your analysis about the economic beginnings, namely the deregulation of the banks. I have two points I want to inquire about. I think it's a right. It started with a right-wing conspiracy, and the second point is, I haven't heard. I'm not hearing anyone say how they're going to drag in all these trillions of dollars that have been created.
Well, I always say when you offered up a conspiracy or a stuff up, 90% of the time it's a stuff up.
And I've got to say, there's no way you could conspire for all this to happen. I mean, who are the people who came together to conspire? Anyway, where is all the money going to be spent, Stephen?
Well, certainly it was a deregulation conspiracy, you could argue, that they did believe in extreme capitalism, let the market decide, and clearly you need some regulation. So I think that's the big lesson. Where are the trillions coming from? Well, the printing presses are going full bore down at the Federal Reserve, and all over the world they are printing with their ears pinned back. And at the end of the day, you can do that. You couldn't do that in the Weimar Republic or in Zimbabwe because if you've got inflation, you can't print money to deal with inflation. But the world has just been through the biggest deflationary crash that we've ever seen in a one-year period. And so you can keep printing money, and that's what the Americans are doing, until the asset values reflate. And that basically is the strategy. Reduce the cost of money to nothing, print, and attempt to try and rebuild some confidence. It's a clifftop poker act that they're performing, that's for sure.
Yes, and I love how right-wing conspiracy ends up with socialism in America. Now, June. G'day, June. Hello, June.
Oh, it's Jenny, actually.
Jenny, I'm sorry, Jenny.
Yes, well, I think the most enjoyable news item of the year was George Bush evading the shoe-throwing incident. It's the only time in his whole 8-year presidency that he's shown to be adept.
Okay. June, thanks very much for that. Stephen, that was a remarkable thing because it seemed, I mean, it was kind of big for a day or two, but it seemingly passed without too much comment. I mean, someone has thrown two shoes at the US president and he kind of laughed it off. I just find it stunning.
Well, I think he's become a bit of a laughingstock, though. I mean, he came to Australia to open APEC and said he was opening OPEC.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the whole show's been one sort of vaudeville thing for the comedians to... So I think, I mean, at the end of the day, it was quite symbolic for where America is at. That if you consider all these events that, you know, Eliot Spitzer, the governor of New York, resigns in disgrace with a scandal about... a hooker. Barack Obama's seat was going to be auctioned off by his corrupt governor, Jay Blagojevich. The president of the NASDAQ Stock Exchange has been caught out running a Ponzi scheme, which has ripped off US $75 billion. The Americans have nationalized their biggest bank, Citigroup, their biggest insurer, AIG. Fannie and Freddie have fallen over. Iraq hasn't gone well. You know. So at the end, to summarize all of that, it's sort of almost symbolic, I think, that you'd have a shoe thrown at the president who's presided over this chaos. And because it's right near the end of his reign, I think people sort of laughed it off. Although Barbara Bush was on Fox today in the US saying she didn't see the funny side of it. But you have to laugh. I mean, it was a heck of a good throw. Two good throws and a great dodge.
Kudos all round, as the Americans would say. But I just think, you know, there's going to be serious questions asked at the Secret Service, I am sure. It could have been anything. What if it was a billiard ball or something like that? Valerie, hello.
Hello. I want to speak about Australia.
Yes, the movie, not the country.
Well, it seems as though really I shouldn't be speaking about Australia because you're speaking about things that are much more serious.
That's all right, we've mentioned it,
Valerie. But in actual fact, I liked the film.
Yep.
I thought it was very, very unproper. Some of the things were so bad, especially when they took the mob from Darwin to...
to Darwin, from far away down. Yep.
Yeah. I come from a country property, and there's no way you would drove those sheep and load them.
They were cattle, I think.
There were so many things that were wrong.
Yeah, it wasn't a documentary, Valerie.
I know it wasn't, but we shouldn't present the world as our country.
But hang on, Valerie, you liked the film.
I did.
Okay. All right. I appreciate that. Interesting. And they were cattle, not sheep, but that's all right. Rashmi, hello.
Hello there. Do you remember Baby Colin the humpback whale?
Yes, I do.
Yes, well, I found that very sad. It was Mother Nature and natural selection mixed with human intervention. I thought Baby Colin could have been saved.
Why did you think it could have been saved? I think one of the things that we found was, in fact, poor old Colin couldn't be saved.
Well, I think he could have been, because they were looking more at the long term. Like, if they had taken Baby Colin all the way to SeaWorld, they could have, like, dealt with him for the short term and then had a long-term strategy to look after him. It was, you know,
Look, I appreciate the everyone was interested in the welfare of this poor whale, but I think once they did an autopsy on the whale... or a post-mortem. The whale wasn't going to survive in the short term or long term, unfortunately. But it did capture our attention.
It did. Okay. Especially on the breakfast shows.
Exactly right. Rashmi, thank you very much. That's interesting. That's a story that maybe has been forgotten in all of this, Stephen?
Yeah, it was like a very memorable story. It ran for a couple of days there. I mean, I think the authorities did absolutely everything they could. Was certainly my memory of it. But, I mean, whaling was also another interesting issue with... The Rudd government initially going in pretty hard with the Japanese experiments, sending in a naval ship and in opposition promising to take legal action, et cetera, et cetera. And I think it's interesting how they've now backed off on quite a bit of that. And there was an altercation between a Japanese whaling ship and the Sea Shepherd, I think, in the last 48 hours, a clash down near the Antarctic, and no Australian ships to be seen down there. So that issue certainly continues to bubble on as well.
1-300-800-222. I'd like to talk about your biggest news stories of the year. G'day, Greg.
Right, how are you going?
Fine, thanks. You want to talk about the New South Wales government?
Yes, hello, Stephen.
Hi, Greg.
Yes, I think the faith of the true believers out there was sorely tested by the musical chairs with the collapse of the state government rapid departure of IEMA, Watkins, Costa et al. Was unfortunate because it further destabilised the state in the way that service delivery is performed, and I think it gives an open door to Fatih Arbel in Sabatier's time.
A long way to go yet, I've got to say, but Stephen, you seem to think that it's all over for the Labor government.
Well, I think clearly they're the most unpopular government in the country, and they're the most financially straitened. I mean, they're borrowing $15 million a day, every single day, and their borrowing program for this year is $7 or $8 billion, and their revenues are collapsing. So, they've already got the highest taxes in the country. Their economy has slowed worse than any other economy. Their house prices have fallen further. Their home loan delinquencies are higher. The retail spending is lower. So basically, all the economics points to political mismanagement contributing to economic decline. Mm. And I think you will eventually see the Rudd government will have to step in. And an interesting connection between, obviously, Anthony Albanese and his the federal infrastructure minister, who just unveiled a big $5 billion infrastructure program, which was focused primarily around New South Wales, and his wife, Carmel Tebbutt, who's the deputy premier of New South Wales. But that will be a very interesting story to watch in the coming year, and I think you will see direct financial assistance coming New South Wales's way, because no state's been able to borrow money ever since the guarantee was put on, because the state money isn't guaranteed. So why would anyone lend state government's money if it's not guaranteed, when you can lend money to the Commonwealth Bank and it is guaranteed? So I think you will see either the guarantee extend to the states or just the feds directly borrowing to bail out the states.
Just on that, and one thing that Greg did mention, but we saw almost the behind-the-scenes stuff was happening at the front of the stage with the manipulation of the resignation of Maurice Viema by a couple of backroom members of Parliament.
Well, I often say that as governments go on over time, you see more sort of cynical self-interest emerge with the power players. And obviously with the Labor Party system of factions, often ultimately controlled by unions, you do see a heightened power within the party's administrative wing and the factional warlords. So clearly, Maurice Viema wanted to push through privatisation. He was rolled by his party, and then he and his treasurer, Michael Costa, didn't want to cop the medicine from that. He then wanted to do a cabinet reshuffle, which was going to impact on the likes of Joe Tripodi, a big factional player, and he was off with his head. Mm. So I think that that just the way he was summarily dealt with, and even the way Frank Sartor was dealt with, who was regarded as very much a sort of an independent straight shooter, not particularly factionally aligned, has heightened the cynicism around just, factional players wielding power for power's sake and not delivering the outcomes that the citizens of New South Wales are looking for in taxes, service delivery or anything else.
All right, Brian, you want to talk about pensions?
Yes. Good night to you both. Mm-hmm. I'd just be interested to know if you've got any comments about the situation where we hear about superannuation values falling, et cetera, et cetera. And I've heard innuendos and I've heard hints from the Prime Minister, the Deputy Prime Minister, the relevant minister.
Yeah.
But no word of positive assurance to aged pensioners about the level of how the aged pension may be affected, if it will be, by this current financial crisis. Would you have comments?
Yeah. Well, very good point. Stephen Mayne, the aged pension. And, of course, it's one of those things that every government wants it to increase, but very few of them actually do it.
Well, I would have said if we hadn't had the financial crisis that there would have been a definite over CPI permanent increase in the age pension. Instead, we've had a lot of one-off increases, like you've just had the $1,000 pre-Christmas, December 8th. You had the Rudd government did the increase in the utilities allowance. John Howard did some one-off increases. But at the end of the day, everyone's income across the country is being slammed by this unprecedented global financial crisis. Yet pensioners do have a fixed guaranteed income, which is CPI adjusted. So if we suddenly see a federal government which is in deficit, which I think we will see, plus a federal government which is talking about nation building and spending tens of billions of dollars on infrastructure, it's no magic pudding. You can't do it all. So I would say that you definitely won't see, in my view, a permanent increase in the aged pension, but you won't see it getting cut. So it won't be that bad that pensions will be frozen. But pensioners are going to have to have the benefit of just lower petrol prices and lower inflation, and at least we haven't lost our 50% in the share market like a lot of other people, but you won't find it getting cut in real terms.
All right. Robbie thought the 2020 summit was a huge success. G'day, Robbie.
Hello. I think it was a very good idea, because during the Howard years, anyone with any knowledge or expertise was denigrated as a cafe latte drinking elite. And just the fact that he brought people who had knowledge and expertise in their fields back in out of the cold was a very good thing.
Okay. I don't know that everyone was dismissed during the Howard years, but I understand your point. But
Well, he just seemed to like to, anyone that didn't agree with him, he would put them down no matter what. I'm thinking of, for instance, scientists who wanted to mention climate change.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah.
All right, good point, Robbie, and thank you very much for that. But, Stephen, a great idea, maybe, the 2020 summit, derided by many in the so-called chattering classes. But what's come of it? I mean, there were supposed to be reports by the end of the year. Have they actually appeared?
Oh, I haven't seen any yet. There have been, all the different streams have been working on their different reports. And some streams were said to have gone better than others. But I think overall, at the end of the day, it was a symbolic exercise to get people to shift away from the 24-hour media cycle and to actually look slightly further ahead in time, and also to symbolically demonstrate that the government was new and fresh and looking for ideas and was listening. I think the way they selected who was coming was certainly portrayed as a sort of a Labor-loving and too many of sort of the Hugh Jackmans and the Kate Blanchetts. But overall, I think anything which increases dialogue and gets some more people into Canberra, apart from the professionals, is a worthwhile thing. Although your point is good, Rod, that we haven't seen anything tangible that's come out of it yet, and the whole agenda sort of been overwhelmed by the whole global financial crisis, unfortunately.
Someone would have to pay for the pies in the sky and the castles in the air, and that may not happen. And 2020, I think Kevin Rudd will be living probably on the Gold Coast in his index pension.
I think that's right. And by 2020, under Kevin Rudd's plan, the most we will have cut our emissions by is 15%. So I think that was the other very important 2020 thing of the year, was that after all the hot air around we're taking climate change seriously, I think a lot of people looked at that and said, 5 to 15% by 2020, plus you're going to raise $80 billion a year in taxes but give most of it back to the big polluters. That was, I think, a bit of a damp squib, and I think that one will come back and bite the government with particularly the Green movement getting energised around the need for some more serious action.
There's so much more we could have talked about. We didn't even mention World Youth Day, which so many people were worried about, and then by the day after the Pope left, everyone had forgotten about it.
It was like the Y2K bug, wasn't it? Overhyped and then went off, no problems at all.
Yeah, it was a great success, and it was great that the Pope came to Australia. But I don't know. I think people wanted something long, and maybe there is a greater residual benefit that perhaps we don't know about. But I don't know. It was huge crowds to see the Pope when he did go through Sydney, and a lot of people came to Australia. But you never hear in the list of the highlights of the year, there's very few mentions of World Youth Day.
No, but it was a great success. I agree with that.
Stephen, thank you so much. I really appreciate talking to you, and maybe we can do it again next year. But look, have a very happy New Year's Eve and a great 2009. I'm sure it'll be something that we can't even imagine what it holds. We couldn't have predicted 2008. We're not going to predict 2009. So thank you very, very much.
It's a pleasure. All the best to you and your listeners.
Thank you. Stephen Mayne, shareholder activist, founder of Crikey, General Gadfly.